You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Okay, welcome to Red Setter, episode 16. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good, good. I'm not sure we need to. I mean, not that we don't need to. I'm always dubious about the what number we're up to thing.
Yeah, maybe
it's
just
it's a podcasting thing, isn't it? Like, TV apps don't do that. Like, hello, welcome to, you know, the nightly evening news. We're up to the 4,656th episode.
They don't give
news.
You the date at the beginning of the news.
But
maybe we'll just skip it.
I am very glad to be here talking with you because, as somebody said to me on iChat just moments ago, quite a lot to talk about this week.
Yeah, it's been a big week in Red, I guess, as they say. I've been getting the same sort of comments from Twitter, people saying, oh my God.
Yes, what next? We discovered Jim is the fifth Cylon. So we're going to talk about the news this week, obviously. Huge news. If you have been you've been in a rock and under a tree and in a cave, that's probably not a bad place to be. But and then we're going to talk about some of the stuff that we mentioned last week, which is review of Monkey Extract. We're also going to follow up on that 8mm lens that we talked to you about in our lens section. And we've got a really good Red Setter this week. In fact, an exceptionally good Red Setter. They've all been good lately, actually.
Yeah, look, we've got a great interview with an Australian director. We have an Australian.
What, another one?
We haven't had one for a little while.
No, no, that's fine.
A fantastic car director here in Sydney, in Queensland, Mark Toyer, who's got tons of fabulous stories.
And quite a few Reds, actually.
Yeah, he's got a bit of an armory and his own gear, his own studios, his own Final Cut Pros, you name it.
Yeah, and we're going to get practical with him on what he finds in the field in terms of making high-end commercials and what he needs to do out of the Red. But first, let's discuss the bombshells that were released this week in rapid succession through Red User.
Yeah, I was all ready. I was all set. I'd sold off all my... Not that I'm any kind of Red fanboy or anything. Sold off all my Stills gear. I thought, oh, look, there's too much going on. I'll just I'll sit on this decision for a minute. And then, man, everything just changed. Well, obviously, one of the main sort of triggers over the last few months or a few weeks for these decisions has been a lot of photokina stuff, Nikon's D90 and Canon's D5 Mark II. Apart from a lot of other things that have been coming out of the woodwork, a lot of Stills gear has been coming up with the ability to do some pretty impressive video. So probably that and a few other things. The fact that the market is changing so fast.
So you think that's behind Red's announcement this week that they've decided to scrap the current plans for the Scarlett and, in fact, for the Epic and go back to the drawing boards, though maintaining the same schedule that they'd suggested before?
Which is pretty wild. Impressive. Well, it's slightly the same. It was meant to be early 09. Now I think it probably... I'm hearing things of, mid 09. One of the comments was, I feel comfortable that we won't be 6 months late.
Who said that?
Jim, I'm sure. We won't be 6 months late, barring a major surprise. So it'll be a little bit of a delay, but that's sort of substantial. I'm sure everyone will be quite happy to wait for that, for that delay, if it means we're going to get what should be something a lot better out of the end of it.
Well, before we go into commentary on it, let's just go through what we know, because what we know is not that long, but we should just, for those people that have only heard about this, but I'm looking to us to illuminate them as to the actual facts of the situation.
Yeah, okay, so basically, if you look at the front page of Red at the moment, well, at the time of recording, basically there used to be four nice little pictures in a row of Epic, Red One, Scarlett, and Red Ray, and there's two little blanks there at the moment saying, in the process of change. Scarlett and Red and Epic are basically changing everything, basically. This is the comment basically from Jim's post. We've changed everything about Scarlett because the market has changed, and we've discovered a lot of things in the process. We have a new vision. Wipe your minds of the past, announce Scarlett, forget the design and forget the price. It's all different now. We think you'll be surprised and glad we didn't take any deposits. What we do know, Scarlett is being redesigned. The name will remain. There'll be an announcement of the specs will come at some point before NAB. I think it'll probably be in the next month or so. I'm sure they'll want to get some info out to a lot of people as soon as possible. They're aiming to have a working model at NAB 09. and aiming to ship Scarlett sometime after NAB.
Okay, so now NAB, for those that don't know, is the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas in April 2009. And this was, of course, or has been traditionally the place that Red launches stuff. So let me ask you this. The thing that I found intriguing about this announcement, right, is that this was made what had to be, it felt like, about a week and a half after IBC. But at IBC, they were still showing the Scarlett. They were still talking about Scarlett. They were showing the epic mock-up. They were doing all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so it feels to me that either at the time of IBC, literally, or around that time, is when this sort of idea germinated. And because, I mean, you would not have gone to IBC and spent that money doing it that way if you were... You've used IBC to make this announcement.
It's literally a 10-day-old sort of thought and only about a 3-day-old sort of decision. You know, basically, this announcement is literally only been... decided to do it in about 10 days ago, really.
Now, in the lead up to you discussing the facts there, you commented that you thought this was based on stuff to do with the, say, Canon 5D Mark II kind of stuff. Now, I've said in the past that if any company could rival Red in producing something that would be Scarlett-esque, it would be Canon, because, in my opinion, Canon has the sensor ability, the lens ability, no entrenched market committed to tape formats. In other words, it's not like a Sony that makes big SR machines and has $100,000 kind of, you know, hard, what it calls, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, they do make some reasonably big broadcast lenses and things.
Oh, yeah, but, it's not like there's a post-production pipeline that they're committed to. It's not like
but the like Sony. XL1Hs and XL1s and all that sort of stuff. They've got some cameras sort of, not at the major Red end of town, but, you know, in sort of Scarlett territory, I guess.
Yeah, but they're the most, they're comfortable with the technology in almost all areas.
Yes.
And, of course, with their stills background, they're comfortable with big sensors.
Yeah.
So Nikon came first, right, with their announcement, I think, and then Canon followed with the 5D Mark II. But you managed to find a really interesting clip that we might refer to that to actually show what that looks like. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, look, there's a stills photographer. Let me just find the scroll down to my link here. Okay. You got it there, Mike?
Yeah. So a guy called Vince Lafort, as in blog.vincentlaforet.com, and this is something that you showed me, Jay, so I hadn't seen this before, but this is a guy who basically got hold of the Mark II 5D. Now, I have the 5D Mark I, and I love it, but he got the Mark II, which shoots 30 frame a second HD material. He bought it for 72 hours. They went out and they shot a bunch of stuff, including, you know, helicopter shots.
It did pretty well. There's some pretty impressive images there. You know, it's quite, you know, it's a little bit cheesy.
But it's a little bit, like New York model. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
well.
sure. But, I mean, it's fantastic imagery. I'm not seeing any rolling shutter artifacts. I'm not seeing any of this stuff. But obviously, you know, it looks incredibly tapey. Mainly, the main thing is in shutter speeds. So, I think it's doing some impressive imagery. It's shooting 30 frames a second. It's shooting H.264. It's got a reasonable data rate, and the images look great. Just hoping that they'll be able to update the firmware before it really ships and give us 24p or 25p.
You jumped over 2 points there that I actually find to be pretty big ones. That it is 30p and only 30p, and then you said it shoots H.264?
I believe so.
Which is, you know, appalling for King.
Sure.
I mean, so this is not going to produce HD production stuff. This is not going to produce stuff that is at the level they currently spec'd the Scarlett at.
Yeah.
So yet alone, presumably the reason the Scarlett was... you know, going back into redesign is because they can do better things. They certainly indicated that it's a better thing. It's a good thing. So what we're looking at here is something that's inferior to the old specs of Scarlett, but it has, you know, Canon lenses on it, and Canon lenses are
apart pretty from interchangeable lenses and, you know, a full frame 35mm still size sensor, which even Red One doesn't have.
Yes, but it is outputting 1920x1080, right?
Yes.
So it's less than 2K.
Absolutely.
And it's what, $2,500 for the camera without a lens?
Have to be around.
And then you've got to factor in the H.264 thing. So generally speaking, really good for doing stuff. But But this so ties into the discussion we had last week, which is this whole idea of stills photographer as sort of pseudo-journalist at the same time. Like, you might be the stills photographer for the Washington Post, but you're expected to also grab some video for their website. And I can see it playing well in that space. I just can't see it playing in the same space that we're talking about with, say, Scarlett. Now, that being said, the Scarlett Epic thing is in addition to this sort of new digital SLR thing that Red spoke about the week before that we mentioned last week.
Yeah, I've been racking my brains about this whole positioning things and where Red and where Scarlett and DSMC should sit in the whole sort of scheme of things. And it's I don't envy Red's marketing decisions they have to make now, and obviously ones that they've now started to make, because where do you go with this? It's kind of wild.
Well, let's discuss this, because I mean, obviously, we that's like we're up to the point where we've said, okay, everything up until now is the facts we know, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
So let's just speculate for a second, and I mean speculate in an intelligent sense. So we've got a sensor in the Scarlett. We know this from the thing we published that Stu published. We've known it for a while. The sensor is going to be relatively small in the old Scarlett. Epic, of course, big. And Red One, fairly big. Well, fairly big. Not quite as big as this Canon 5D. Sure. Now, the Canon 5D has the big sensor size. Doesn't actually give us anything in terms of the video production that we really want. It gives us some stuff that's sort of cool in terms of an HD sense. But feels more like a video tap off the live view that's the back of the camera, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So that begs the question, where would you go if you had a perfect environment with Red? And I've got to be thinking that the idea of Scarlett having the small sensor is probably the least attractive part of the Scarlett profile at the moment. Would you agree?
Yeah. For some people, it's the fact that it doesn't have interchangeable lenses, and I guess that's where DSMC was going to tap into that side of things. But yeah, probably the small sensor size, really. But what it was going to do is 120 frames or 180 frames a second burst.
Okay, now here's the real thing, because when we talk about putting stills lens on something like a Red and stuff, we tend to throw away the thing that most people find phenomenally useful with a stills lens, which is superb autofocusing. I mean, really just outstanding. Yeah. Now, Red has shown no technology in the area of autofocus whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, you know, the exact opposite. This, you couldn't get more manual than you've got on the Red One. So I've got to be thinking that if you're going to go into the digital SLR market, it's going to be a play that has to relate to the lenses in terms of their automatic functioning, automatic exposure, automatic focus in particular, neither of which we've seen anything of at all in the technological tent that we might call, you know, the Red One Village. So that's one possibility, because the sensor size is another in terms of scale. You mentioned the interchangeable lenses, and yet I got a feeling that not based on fact, one of the advantages of not having interchangeable lenses is you could calibrate them really well. And I'm thinking here of doing things like stereoscopic and other things.
Yeah. Look, the interchangeable thing never bothered me with the Scarlett. It bothered a lot of people. There was a lot of static about it when it was first announced, and people still would love that. You know, now that this rethink has been announced, people are going, ooh, great. Now you can do interchangeable lenses. I really don't think that's Scarlett's job. I think
I'm going to argue with you on that point, because the thing I was most disappointed about, I was one of the people that wanted interchangeable, and what I wanted was Canon interchangeable lenses, because I'm thinking, you've got a lot of glass already, like me, you've got a stills camera, why not use that glass? Because I don't want to have to, for a Scarlett level camera, buy new lenses.
Yeah, but then, so then that asks the question, what is DSMC going to be? If it's going to be a DSLR killer, obviously it's going to have, you know, independent changeable lenses. I presume maybe you can choose Canon or Nikon mount. If it's going to be any kind of DSLR killer, it's going to have at least full frame or even larger, at least full frame 35mm sensor.
Are there legal implications if they decide to, say, go with a Canon mount, for Canon being able to say, well, that's our lens, we're proprietary? Because does anybody else make Canon film backs that take Canon lenses in the sort of big commercial sense?
Is there still any kind of proprietary, is there still copyright, or is there still trademarks and patents on the Canon mount, really?
If they didn't do a deal with Nikon or Canon and just said, oh, you can use your Canon or Nikons, and then Canon comes along and says, no, sorry, can't do it. It would invalidate the entire product.
True.
And yet if they come out and say, we're going to do our own lenses, which, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, they're great, they can do their own lenses. I'm like, well, hang on a second. That technology of that autofocus stuff, I mean, that's some pretty wickedly, you know, proprietary technology. As I said, Red show nothing in this area.
But it's technology designed around stills. It's designed to point, seek, attack the focus point, bang, you fire. It's not designed for, I'm sure it's not designed to be used with a motion picture sort of system. There, I saw some clips of the 5D Mark II just being shot around at some sort of Japanese trade show. And I could clearly see, it was a motion clip, but I could clearly see exactly what you see when you start pointing an SLR around the room. It's kind of like hunting, and you press a button, bang, the focus gets sharp, bang, the focus gets sharp. There was no sort of, the whole servo sort of constant focus thing really isn't as good in a stills camera as it is in.
Yeah, but you've got to do it if you're going to claim that you're going after the DLSR market, because the DLSR market by definition is a combination of stills and moving, and the second you hit stills, you absolutely need that stuff.
Yeah, look, I mean, before this whole announcement came, I sort of think, right, great, okay, I'm going to get a Scarlett. Fabulous, I'll get one of those. And then DSMC came up, and I thought, do I want one of those instead? because I love...
Other people like Sigma make Sigma lenses that sit on a Canon film back, right?
Yeah, right.
So we're talking about the reverse of that, except for the fact that I guess you could argue that Red could do a deal with someone like that. Sigma made... If Sigma, who does make good lenses, like I have their 8mm fisheye, you know, you could say, well, let's rebrand those and suddenly come out with a whole line of Canon-compatible, made not by Canon lenses.
That's true. Obviously Sigma have to pay a licensing fee to be able to make Canon lenses, I guess.
Canon-compatible lenses, I guess.
Canon-compatible lenses.
It is a really complicated issue. And then then, as you say, muddies the waters in terms of the separation between what Scarlett is and what this DLSR is. And, if this DLSR thingy is going to basically be a better version of what the Canon 5D Mark II is, in other words, it produces something other than heavily compressed H.264, and it produces something that, you know, you've got a bit more control over in terms of 24, 25, that kind of stuff, then... You know, is it just frame rate? I mean, is it, I don't know. It just makes Red. I just think Scarlett's got to have interchangeable lenses and it's got to sit between those two. It's got to go high frame rate. But I don't know, the small sensor, it just seems to me why.
Well, that was the six. I guess that's 2/3 of an inch. That's 16 mil. That was going to be the 16 mil little sort of HVX 200 kind of killer sort of thing. Basically, they don't have interchangeable lenses yet. A lot of the other ones do. A lot of the other ones don't either. You know, a lot of the.
Our P2, but it's getting a bit long in the tooth. I mean, if you allow for the fact that it's, you know, I mean, it's got no. You're right, no interchangeable lenses, and it is recording to data, but only at 720p kind of levels. But
yeah. So you imagine your camera, but then running be able to run 120 frames a second or 180 for a bit of a burst, and to have a slightly bigger, probably twice the size of the sensor that you've got there now, so twice the depth of field, or half
so,
the depth.
So
of
you
field.
Think the old Scarlett would give you twice the depth of field that my current P2 does?
I think you've probably got a 1/3 inch sensor in that thing. So Scarlett was going to be 2/3 of an inch. So that's going to be twice as.
Okay, let me put a completely tangential question to you across this, right? Let's say that this is all happening and we're discussing this now as if it's NAB last year, right?
Yeah.
Or earlier than the year. My question to you is, what does it do for Red as a brand that they say, we've just spent the last 6 months talking about this Scarlett thing, and actually it was never more than an idea, it was never more than a promise, and now we're going to give you a new promise, and we'll see what that is in a couple of weeks. Does it mean that the next time they do this, we're going to completely discount what they say or not?
Look, the ideas that they're coming up with are so good every time and so groundbreaking. I think it's the fact that in the time it takes to announce it, somebody else has kind of come close to that mark. So they've gone, okay, hang on, what was groundbreaking is now not so, I think, basically. So, yeah, look, I think everyone will still be keen, whatever they come up with.
So where's the projector? Where's the 4K monitor? Because those are the two things that were also promised sometime around 2 years ago.
This is a company that's very open in its thought processes. I can do a post now and probably in 5 minutes have a reply from the CEO of the company. You know, they are really wear their sort of heart on their sleeve, I guess. Every sort of thought and every great idea is almost is shared with their users. So that is, as we've mentioned before, is a real double-edged sword, that we get to see the stuff they've got in development. No other company really shows you that. There's how many things probably in the whole time we've been having this podcast that Sony have come up with and thrown away and come up with and thrown away, and we would never have even known. We get to hear about these things because they're a caring, sharing company.
But does that age? I'm just asking the questions, right? Like, does it become like next gen AB? They go, we're going to come out with this blah blah camera, and everyone just goes, well, clearly you may or may not. It's just, you know, it's a bit early to say, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, you really want to commit? I mean, Red Ray. Haven't heard much about it.
No.
Assume it's still there because it's on the front page of the website.
Yeah.
The monitors and the, and the projectors really interest me a lot. Haven't heard anything about those for a while. And yet, I also have sort of read between the lines, or maybe not so much between the lines, that they're still going to have some amazing stuff to blow us away at NAB. And, you know, we're only talking about 6 months away. I mean, how long does it take to put something into production? I would have thought 6 months, even for a company with experience in the consumer retail, or sorry, the consumer market, these guys have, it's pretty bloody short.
I mean, they've done a lot of the development with the Red One. Essentially, the camera you bought was like a beta. You were a beta site. You know, a lot of the updates and the upgrades and the things that where Sony would do that behind closed doors, and they'd fix all those things up and all the sort of changes and audio board upgrades and all that sort of stuff, that will all happen behind doors before you. And then the final thing that Sony or Canon or whoever would, or Panavision that would release, would be, you know, the final thing, and that's the way it would stay. You guys have, and every owner of a Red One has been part of that sort of R&D process, and willingly, you know. Mm. So, look, I guess the trick will be with Scarlett, that it's going to be a much more mass produced item. They're going to have to, and they know they're going to have to make a lot more of them. I know. Can you imagine how many? If Scarlett was released tomorrow, within 5 days they'd have 20,000, 30,000 orders. They were going to have to be producing them on a much different scale to how they've done with Red One. So you couldn't possibly do what you did with Scarlett, do what they did with Red One with Scarlett. You couldn't have 20,000 cameras all going back for a retrofit of this or that or the other, or 20,000 cameras going back for a mount. It would be insane.
Yeah,
the cameras that go out the door, it would have to be, I guess, if they're going to ship them in the numbers that they plan to, or should imagine that they plan to, they're going to have to be all the more ready for prime time.
See, the thing is, we cut Red a lot of slack in some respects, but this is, as you say, the exact opposite approach of the other company which I cut a lot of slack for, which is Apple. I mean, Apple tells me nothing until it's in the store.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, as I said, just whether or not either of those two strategies date, whether or not it's possible that, you know, one of those two strategies is now, you know, is it that in the old days we used to be really comfortable doing that, and that increasingly we want that transparency? Because, you know, literally the Harvard Business Review would argue that this policy of completely open all your mistakes in public approach is incredibly good at building brand loyalty. Though, as I did in a talk recently, I pointed out, well, yes, if Apple has, you know, mega fanboys and they do the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So I guess, is it just a small group of, I don't think so. I think a big group of people are really hanging back to see what Scarlett is.
There's a lot of people that are ready to just sort of take it. Exactly the same thing with Apple. You know, as soon as something released, bang, great, whatever it is. People sort of, you know, have their friends standing in Apple stores, you know, when the next keynote comes, saying, whatever it is, I'll have five. You know, whatever it announces, I'll have one of each of every color.
I have a confession to make. I once went down to the Apple store and said, can you put an order in for whatever it is they announce tomorrow? Because I, yeah. I shouldn't have done that, but there you go. I had a fair idea what it was likely to be.
Look, people have been willing to put up with... Not put up. I mean, it's been fantastic. It's been an interesting ride. But people have been doing what they've been doing with Red and sort of feeding back and putting up with sort of having parts swapped over and having to FedEx your camera back and all that sort of stuff. Admittedly, all of that at Red's expense. But you're willing to put up with that because it is the Red One has been so ahead of the curve of anything else that's out there for the price point. People are willing to, if something is so radically different and so, you know, so much more affordable for what's out there, and if it's giving you such a different experience, people will happily, you know, be a beta site for it.
Or an alpha site. So let's just talk about some of the other stuff that is being released.
Okay.
Red RAM.
Epic. Same thing.
Okay. The whole discussion again for Epic.
Well, I mean, that is a point. Epic has done the same thing. It's gone into turnaround, I guess. The same rethink. I'm not quite sure why on this stage of things. Maybe they want. Maybe in the whole development of the DSMC, they've realised in working out in the new digital stills and motion camera, there's been some eureka moments. That thought, hang on, when we bring this thing out, it's going to shit all over Epic. It's going to shit all over Scarlett. You know, everyone's going to. Maybe there's in the 6 months it's taken them from the announcement of Scarlett. There's been, you know, some major sort of thought processes that have gone ahead that have thought, well, hang on, this is some fantastic technology we've got here with this new thing. We can, you know, we can do better with the stuff we haven't yet released yet. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So Red RAM.
Why are you laughing?
Well, no, just because it's like we're 26 minutes in and all we've discussed is the fact that they've decided to not do anything that we thought that they were doing.
I knew this would be hard to discuss. I started to think, how the hell do you explain this? I mean, we just have to sit on it.
We
stayed away from talking about the whole Scarlett thing for a long time because for so long it's just been...
I'm glad we did because it would have been a fairly moot point at this thing. We spent three episodes talking about something completely thrown out the window.
And still on this point, I reckon maybe... They'll probably find that the DSMC and the Scarlett will merge. It'll be one thing.
Let me ask you final word. Okay. Final word on this particular topic, be it Epic or Scarlett. Do you feel rewarded or betrayed by that announcement with sort of initial reaction? Here you are. You do a podcast about this product, right? You obviously invested heavily in it in terms of emotional commitment, not in terms of actual gear.
Wow. No, not in terms of gear. I was ready.
No, I've invested in terms of gear. You've just invested in terms... But no, seriously, you do a podcast about it every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like an A-grade grade. You've got a lot of other things you could be doing. Actually earning some money.
You should be doing. Unpacking the dishwasher. Okay, there you go. You know, reading children's stories.
Did you read it and go, wow, my team's going well? Or did you read it and go, oh, God, what have they done to me now?
Oh God, what have they done to me now in terms of podcasting? Because like I'm here, I knew I'd be here going, well, what the hell do I say about all this? Look, I know that whatever it is, it's for the right reason. You know, when they're not going to turn around and produce something that's going to be, you know, 30% shittier. You know it's going to be, whatever this change of heart has been driven by, it'll be because it'll be better and because they want to do it better than Canon, better, you know, they're very competitive, competitive. Yeah, they always definitely want to be able to sort of turn around and say, whatever you guys are making, we're going to eat your lunch.
Okay, well, moving away now from our alpha male discussion. Red RAM was going to be 64 gig, is now 128 gig for the same price.
Yes, but there's still no real actual Red RAM you can actually go and buy yet. No. I did read something that maybe it'll be about a month away. But would you buy a Red RAM? $4,500?
I'm getting more inclined to at 128 gig. I wasn't inclined to at 64 gig at all.
It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but then... you know, like a fail-safe kind of... Now, if you're doing a feature film, I could imagine that that's starting to become, you know, a doable thing. I thought 64 for 4,500 was not such a great deal.
It's like 10 or whatever, however many. You're the maths half of the brain here. That's like 10 or 12, whatever, 12 gig cards. 10 and a bit.
12 gig cards?
Well, 16 gig. How many 16 gig cards is it? Sorry.
Well, 8, obviously.
8, of course. Obviously.
But... But okay. But anyway, for $4,500 US, which by the way is more Australian dollars than it used to be when we started this podcast. Okay, so anyway, it's
improving. See again, that's it's improvement.
You're just so excited this week. Anyway. Other red news, which I think is really interesting for me personally, because I don't care about you, is that the red lens, the favoured
18 to 85,
yes, is now shipping.
Yeah, awesome.
T2.9. So that is a lens that I have been waiting for.
Is it a constant 2.9?
That's a really good question. Okay. I don't have the answer to that. I think it is. I know that there's almost no information about it on the. I think it is.
It's not in the store.
It's not in the store. It's not at the site. It is, however, shipping.
Right.
The details are that they are shipping about 50 of them mm-hmm. per month.
Yep.
And they're doing it in camera order. So
right.
That's why
off you go then.
That's why I'm getting one of the first ones. And excellent. And yes, I am. I am getting one of the first ones because I asked for it. And
excellent.
I'm going to pay the money for it and everything. Excellent. But I am disappointed to hear that there'll be no iData in the 18 to 85.
Yep.
I mean, there's no iData in the primes, but I kind of accepted that in the primes because they're not zooms and I really want to know what they're doing zoom-wise. So that's one of the main reasons I wanted them, right?
There's no data in any of the red lenses anyway.
No, that's not true. That isn't is it? Absolutely not true.
Okay.
In the current lens I have, which is the original red zoom.
18 to 50.
They snuck into... Well, this is kind of funny. They snuck into build 16 the capacity for grabbing the iTech data.
Yep.
They snuck into... Or not snuck in, particularly. Build 17, the same thing. And they've, in the audio mod to our camera, put back our three little gold pins in the PL mount for the iTech data.
Yep.
All good. Except for the fact that as we speak, there's actually no application that'll get you the data out. There's no application that'll read it. There's mm-hmm. no application that'll publish it. And there's no application that'll rip it out. Having said that, our good friends at the mothership have promised that that is coming real soon now.
Okay.
Because the data is now, in fact, being generated by the lens and by the
now,
camera.
Now, when this all gets launched, I want to see some serious stuff from you guys about this. I mean, obviously,
bloody
it's
oath.
Been very exciting. You've been very... it's your turn to be excited.
I'm very excited.
Talk about exciting. So it'd be interesting to see what this really means to you guys, because I know you've said it's very important, but...
it offers an interesting area of post-production future growth for the whole industry than when we start having effectively what is a digital lens.
Yeah.
That's a dumb way of putting it, but it is effectively what it is. It's a lens that starts producing data. But anyway, I'm glad that shipping. We hope to get one soon and we'll test it. When we do guess it, we will let you guys know.
So you've got an 18 to 50 to sell.
Yeah, I kind of like my 18 to 50 because it still has the iTech data in it, so I'm probably not going to sell it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not a selling lens kind of guy, really. Okay, now I promised last week that, getting back on schedule, because we said, oh, this week will be short. This week we won't go over. This week will be different.
Nah, yes. What's short? Long,
okay.
Whatever.
So, I promised to discuss with you monkey extract.
Monkey extract.
So,
yes.
let me give you a run through of it. So, firstly, we tested it all this week and had fun with it in our labs. This is a program that is slightly, I think, misleading in its website. And it has this typical workflow diagram that has Avid, Final Cut leads to EDL, EDL leads to monkey extract leads to
right. The Avid
DPX.
Thing is solved.
Solved, yeah. No,
fantastic.
not so much with the solved bit.
Oh, okay.
Now, all it's doing, and it's not to say that it's not a good product, because I think it is, but it's not doing anything clever with Avid. All it's doing is taking an EDL and doing an extract based on what Redline can do. So if Redline can do it, it can do it. And Redline doesn't understand Avid, and Avid doesn't understand, you know, fully R3D, so we're not actually getting that, you know, bit done yet. So that's just what it's doing.
Mm.
But when it does do an extract, so we gave it a EDL, it worked pretty well, and a whole bunch of stuff. There's a trial version on their website if you want to go to it, which is at rubbermonkeysoftware.com. We'll put that in the show notes. So we went in there and we said, okay, we want to do, in our case, a DPX extraction. We want to do, say, I don't know, time of day as our time code format. We loaded up an EDL and we were going to extract our files out and put them somewhere on our server, which is all good. There are a couple of interesting things about it that I'm glad, you know, we had a chance to review it. You know, the Red Alert has a RSX file that's generated in your folder when you go into Red Alert. So you go into Red Alert, open it up, have a look at it, and all of a sudden there's this little text file that's appeared in the folder. Well, that folder is giving us the history of what I just did in Red Alert. So if I go into Red Alert and tweak my QuickTimes effectively, or tweak the view that I have of the data, that's recorded in the RSX, and that can be actually fed into Monkey Extract. So if you are doing a, it takes notice of that, which is nice.
Okay.
We ignored it. We also saw that it still has RedFlex listed under the gamma curve options. So you've got RedSpace and all the PD logs, etc., and RedFlex. So maybe they were on the alpha and never got rid of it, but it's one of the few places you see an explicit RedFlex lying around. Anyway, so then you sort of say we're going to output the stuff. As I said, in our case, it was an edit based on time of day. So we took our EDL from, in our case, Final Cut, fed it in a huge number of R3D files. It threw up where it had problems in the EDL. Now, in our case, those problems were all things like AX, which is an audio, or a BL, which is a black. So black source, it doesn't have an R3D file for those, of course, because they don't exist. So you'd expect it to throw that up as an error. It's not really an error. It's just saying, hey, these aren't R3D files.
Right.
And then what's nice is it starts doing a extraction, and it's showing you what's coming.
Yeah.
What's also nice is that doing this extraction, there is an option for actually specifying frame handles.
Excellent.
So that you can say, like, get me all my shots with 5-frame handles top and bottom, which would be good. And then it literally goes through and just processes all of those out and puts all your files in a folder and gives you a nice little user interface.
Like a little storyboard thing.
Mm-hmm. So you could choose to not extract some of your elements of the edit. Let's say you did all that. You could go, oh, hang on, I just want to extract these three right now, not all of them.
Right.
And you'd be a visual picture of what it was that you were going to extract. So you could tick which ones you wanted and which ones you didn't.
Okay.
And then it takes a while, like Redline does, to export a then bunch of whatever, DBXs or TIFFs or whatever you wanted.
Right.
So a good program, works well. It doesn't do more than it does, and don't be fooled into thinking that it does. But if you want a good graphical user interface and an easy way to work, that's simple and fast, I can recommend it. It's
so you did that workflow just then with Final Cut Pro. So where does the Avid thing fall into there?
Well,
and why is it any better in the Avid sort of arena than the sort of kludgy workarounds we've got at the moment?
No, there is XML stuff coming for Avid, and there's EDLs and stuff happening.
Sure.
It doesn't do anything clever. It's just that if you happen to have an EDL that refers back to the R3D files, for whatever reason, it's going to just extract those from the R3Ds, and that could be an EDL that was sort of manually hacked in Avid if you want.
Yeah.
It doesn't solve the Avid problem, it just solves the extraction problem. Now, that would save you from having to try and get that EDL into, ooh, Red Cine. Wait a sec, Red Cine doesn't take an EDL. See where I'm going with this? Like, in Scratch it does, but not in Red Cine. So
yeah.
Okay. If you want to extract stuff based on timecode, where do you do it? This is how you would do that, and you could do it simply and quickly, insofar as it'll be as quick as, say, doing stuff in Redline.
Yeah.
So that's, and I'm just going to give you the price on that. And give me 1 second and I'll get you that.
I just clicked away from it.
Nope, I've got it here somewhere. And it's, I think it's like $100 and something for a copy to buy it. Here, $159.99. Though, as I said, there is a demo version if you want to try it out and see what we're talking about.
That's now $300 Australian as we talk.
Going up every minute that we speak, every minute that you joke. Yeah, because there's nothing about Wall Street we don't hate. Okay,
yes,
there's another thing that you found I thought was really terrific in terms of somebody wants to get up to speed on the menu structure of their Red, from the guys from XL Films. Tell us about that.
This is cool. This was in the camera case. I was on. I had a shoot on last week, and it was just sitting there on the camera case. I thought, what is that? Get me that thing now. It was this laminate, just simple.
You can do that as a director, can't you? Be very petulant.
You could do that.
Get me that now. I want a latte now.
I probably said. Oh, excuse me. Would you mind if I?
Did you ask your masseur for that? Sorry. Go on.
And my people brought it to me. it was. It's just.
Oh, your producer's going to break your
balls
over that one.
Very simple. Just. It's beautifully done. It's basically just like four sheets, four pages of the Red One workflow, just all mapped out really nice and simply. So, you know, if you want to know how do I adjust, you know, the audio levels or you know, change shutter speeds or go to 4K or 3K or whatever, how do I, you know, if I want to adjust anything, basically it's just a really simple sort of classic kind of just laid out. It's a simple workflow.
It's the quick cheat sheet that isn't provided by Red.
Exactly right. So this is put together by XL Films, and huge shout out to Ken Kosub, Bruce Ingram and Scott Jones at XL Films, even though they didn't return my email.
Yes, but we do like XL Films, and we appreciate them publishing that so anyone can grab it. And that's up to date with Build 16. I don't think they have a Build 17 one out yet.
There's a link in the show notes, but if you just go to xlfilms.tv and go to, there's a link at the top called Red Square. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, look, there's a link to Red Center Podcast. How very nice. Thank you, boys.
So,
and yeah, and you can download the PDFs there. Awesome. Laminate them, chuck them in the box. If you're renting the gear out, especially if you're renting the gear out, I think it'll save you a lot of midnight phone calls.
Okay, so now what we're going to do now is go over to our Red Room for this week here at Red Center to talk to Mark Toyer. And after that, we're going to come back and discuss gear. And that will be the discussion of things like that 8mm lens we mentioned last week and a couple of other things. But let's go now to that interview that you did earlier in the week with Mark. Great guy. I was fortunate enough to go up when he was interested in Red and muck around with him. Though, like you, I first knew his work when he started doing a bunch of award-winning jobs for Yamaha motorbikes.
And yeah.
Phenomenally interesting work. I mean, because he does them consistently year in, year out, you get this snapshot of funny, of serious, of dramatic, of you know, high effects stuff and no effects. And it really did. When they first came out, they just cleaned up the awards, didn't they?
Yeah, it was a very, very... I mean, first of all, because it was a really... What felt like and what looked like a really big budget... commercial for a fairly small product. I mean, not small product, but you don't really see massive ads for, like, you know, dirt bikes. These were really great little sort of portrait pieces on famous dirt bikers and their gear, and it was just beautifully, you know, just really beautifully done, and he, you know, it was a great springboard for him. So,
yeah. And he had a lot of creative freedom in those, because unlike most ads, he really ended up with not carte blanche, but virtually, you know, a working environment free of the constraints of some of the normal advertising agency problems.
I.e. working directly with the client and no goddamn agency in the way.
And not that we're advocating that, nor is he, but it did mean that he got to do this just amazing stuff. And, I was judging a competition in Queensland and it was just too ridiculous. I think they won every category they entered in.
Yeah, I was doing some judging on advertising awards and his stuff came through, and that's nobody knew. I didn't know. I'd never heard of him before, and obviously it's been meteoric since then. Great spots. And if you... what the heck is that?
I've just opened up to show Jason when they first started, they produced one of the, I think, the best books for a production company to use as a marketing piece.
Awesome.
So it was basically, because he came from a stills background, he just did this awesome piece of self-promotion, which was a book, right? And I, desperate for this book, when I saw it, I judged the book. I was in judging TVC, and I saw the book in the judging in the print section, and I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. And the photo I wanted to show, which I'm just holding up to Jason now, but you guys can't see, is they got every piece of kit they could possibly get and laid it out in a huge white psych studio. So imagine a shot which would have, you know, what, several hundred lights.
Take a psych and then empty out your local camera rental place.
But build everything.
Empty out Panavision.
So no crates, just lights, cameras, arms, Kina flows, floods, spots.
Oh, Mark, you've got a gear issue.
But it
Holy crap, that is a lot of gear.
I remember looking at that going, God, I wish I'd thought of that. And the other one they did, which I'll flip through while you're talking, is they got all their staff and they comped a shot to make it look like their staff were all standing on each other's shoulders. And again, it was just one of those shots that everyone looks like having a good time. It sends a message to the client that I have a good range of staff and, like, they'll get on really well and they have a good sense of humor. And it was so much nicer than the normal stupid headshots. You know when you get companies doing stupid headshots?
Yeah.
And
I've done them.
See, look, there it is. There's a shot of these guys all looking like they're standing on each other's shoulders.
Yeah.
It's just a fun shot, and it's just such an original. And I was kind of thinking, you know, these guys have just got a really original attitude to everything that they do. So I was very pleased years after this, which I mean literally like possibly 8 years later, to be working with him. So let's go to that interview now.
Okay, I'm chatting with Mark Toyer, multi-award winning Australian director and DP, and I'm probably safe to say Australia's best car director. Hey Mark, how are you?
Good. Big intro. That's nice.
I could have gone bigger. I was holding it back. Look, so first of all, give us the Zoom story and how that all got started.
I'm from a photographic background. I used to work for a lot of magazines. I did a stint with Reuters. And, I was just a magazine photographer. Then I sort of dabbled in advertising photography. And this was many moons ago. And slowly got myself into the ad world or advertising world, doing print campaigns and so forth. And one day a client came up to me and asked me to do a TV commercial. And I did, because I knew nothing about TV. I knew nothing about 35mm film, even though I was shooting 10.8 film at the time. I got a camera assistant around that I knew that was doing all that sort of stuff. He came around to my studios. I said, please teach me how these 35mm cameras work. 5 beers later, I was all over it. So it's a 35mm camera, to me, was a lot easier to use than a 10.8 Sinar. So I pretty much figured out the whole 35mm thing relatively quickly, and it was so easy. I just fell into it so quickly. And
well, you certainly worked out the whole moving the camera thing, because, I mean, the first stuff that I was aware of your work was all the fantastic Yamaha dirt bike stuff that you did, and that was just, you know, awesome stuff where you really, clearly, it was hard to imagine that there's a stills background there, because so much of it has got such energy and such movement to it that it's not the standard sort of stuff that you expect from someone who's come from that background, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. There's a lot of photographers trying to get into directing, and a lot of them fail, and you always look back and you go, why or how? You know, they've got such, and some of them are incredible photographers and photographers I've looked up to for years, and they've always tried to get into directing and they've just bombed out. And I suppose at the end of the day, it looks like you've got it when it comes to motion and storytelling and so forth, or you haven't, you know. But photographers make great DOPs nonetheless if they've got a good director pushing them around. And I wasn't trained as a director. It just seemed to happen. And mind you, I do a lot of visual ads. You know, ad agencies feel I'm not very good at dialogue. Yeah, it's those Yamaha ads are what really got me going. And they won a lot of awards for me in my early days. And obviously once you start winning international awards, a lot of work starts piling in. The next thing you know, my photography pretty much dropped out of existence in about a year and a half, and I was well into doing TV commercials without even thinking that it was even going to happen. So at the same time, I had a lot of commercial or advertising clients that trusted me as a photographer, and once they realized I did TV ads as well, the transition from the two was very simple.
You got into Red pretty early on. How did that move happen?
It's probably shot him in the foot a little bit, but John Lee, that owns Cutting Edge, he bought one of these Red cameras at NAB 2 years ago when they first launched it. I actually bought his Red slot off him. He just gave me the slot. Because the thing is, he's a post-production house and I'm a film production company, so I needed it. So I took that off him as well. We ordered another 3 or 4 more, I can't remember at the time. So his one turned up. It was camera 158. We thought this would be a nice little camera to have, and we'll stick it in our room with all the other cameras and go, well, that'll be good for all our little tiny jobs that pop into Zoom to be produced. But irrespective of that, we got Mike Seymour up. We flew him up, and he spent a day with us to show us what Red really was and how it really did its stuff. And once Mike Seymour and Jimmy came up, it quickly dawned on us that it was far, far more than that. You know, it was an evolution in digital technology, to be honest. And even in build 15 or build 14, whatever we got it as, that was even good enough already for us. We didn't really need much more because we know how to shoot it probably a lot better than other people. You know, we've dealt with film for so long, we are treating it like a film camera. We're not treating it like a video camera.
Yeah, exactly. So now it's the first thing you reach for, or one of the first things you reach for?
Look, to be honest, since March this year, we did a couple of jobs. Oh, sorry, we R&D'd the hell out of it for about 2 months because there was no way I was just going to get a camera and just turn up on a job with this untested thing in a work environment. So we just tested it and tested it and tested it. The workflow was our biggest concern because straight away we realized the pictures were fine. Even build 15 with its highlights dropping off so quickly, we knew how to shoot around that so not to have that problem. But our workflow was the biggest thing because obviously with film you just shoot it, super, you go to Telecine, you grade it up, it's on tape, it goes into the edit suites and blah, blah, blah. It's a pretty simple process.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, how do we get that simple process with Red? And through a lot of post houses, we couldn't get that simple process. It was, you know, people were rendering out bloody DPXs, they were rendering out files to go to tape. It was just a schmozzle. We were waiting 3 days before we saw stuff. And it was quite honestly given us the shit. So in-house, we just thought, stuff it, we've, you know, I've been planning on putting edit suites in anyway, so we've just set up big 8-core machines, we've just chucked maximum amount of RAM in them, set up RAID systems and put in Final Cut, and voila, we're editing real-time 2K. You know, for us it was so quick. We did a job where it was 4 hours of actual footage shot. It was a quite a large car commercial. It ingests in the Final Cut Pro for us in 5 or 6 seconds, and we're editing. And, you know, the client sits beside me, and when they go, yes, we like that, we just practically render out a ProRes 10-bit file or a 10-bit ProRes animation. I just take that over to the Inferno, to the compositors or whatever effects we're going to do, and job's done.
Right.
So we don't really go back to DPXs, or we don't do anything unless we think the image that we've just shot is a bit underexposed or overexposed. We'll go to Red Alert and just to adjust it ourselves to a flat image so our colorist can grade it.
Right. So you won't do DPXs and go straight out to a full-on grading suite?
No, I can't be bothered. simple reason is if you shoot the shot properly,
yeah,
you've already got a 10-bit log image already. You don't need 16-bit unless you've completely screwed that shot up.
Yeah.
Where you really need to retrieve highlights and you really need to retrieve something from the blacks. I don't need to be grading in 16-bit for a TV commercial. Now, what I'm saying is I would not do it this way if I was doing a film. Sure. If I was doing a film, I would go back to the DPXs or grade directly off the R3Ds.
Obviously, this is all the more easier to do in Build 16 because this picture just looks so good straight out of the box.
Yeah, they do. Look, the thing is, too, I'm not a big fan of Red Space, is it?
Yep.
It seems to be a grade that Red's given us. It's good for the monitors on set. It's good for, viewing on set and so forth and quickly chuck it in a timeline. But in the day, I do like Rec 709 with the lower contrast and everything because it's a bit better for my colorist to grade.
Yep.
So what we do now is we go through and we just get rid of that red space type look and we go back to something quite log looking or really quite flat looking and we give them a 10-bit log file and off you go, you know. But this isn't my be on an end or workflow. I'm just waiting for a great grading system to come online to where, you know, we can work directly off the R3Ds forever then.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that's just around the corner and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at this point in time, we're completely, completely fine. We don't need to go through that whole DPX carry-on.
Well, obviously, one of the other motivating forces, I guess, for going to Red is the closure of the only lab up there in Queensland.
Yeah, that did me nothing but favours, to be honest. It's amazing how many people are screwing up the whole Red thing at the moment. I'm getting constant phone calls from DOPs telling me that Red is crap. But then they see my ads on TV and they go, shit, how did he do it? You know, the lab shutting down was another little nail in the coffin for film, you know, and it's sad to see some jobs go, you know, because a lot of those guys at ATLAB were good mates. But at the same time, all it did was accelerate the amount of work that's come in for us to shoot Red. You know, the whole post-workflow thing is our only other hurdle to get over, but in-house we've got it completely sorted, and it's so fast. It's ridiculously fast, and, yeah, we're getting jobs done so quick it's not funny, and at a resolution and colour resolution and tonal range that I expect. So there's a lot of eyes being lifted, and a lot of people are looking at us at the moment going, why are you getting this and we can't?
It's a secret.
Well, it's not a secret. I'm just doing it the way Mike Seymour told me to do it.
Oh, you got to keep these things close to your chest, Mark.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so simple. What I did the other day, I've actually got my receptionist to walk out and shoot some pictures. You know, the way we've got this thing set up at the moment, anyone can shoot this stuff. You know, someone, as long as the picture in that viewfinder looks good, you've got a good shot. The range that we're getting out of the Red through Red Alert or wherever is just staggering. It's as much as what I've got out of film. I've never got stitched up. We've done shots, and I'll give you a couple of these shots to post on your FX site when you're done.
Yep.
But we've got shots where we've actually been stuck in the middle of the bush or somewhere where the sun has gone down, but the client still wants another shot. You shoot it on the Red camera, you know, you're miles out of its range. You still shot the shot. You're sitting there scratching your head going, there's no way in the world there's going to be an image there. And next thing you know, it's in the ad running on air.
Yep.
3 weeks later. Saved. You go, how have I managed to find 2 to 3 stops and still have a beautiful image at the end of it when I can barely see it on a monitor on set? So, you know, it's an amazing camera, and we're more than happy with it.
You do shoot a lot of car spots. You're probably getting them a lot of abuse, rigging them in and out of cars and slamming them around on rigs. How's that all worked for you?
Look, we had one monumental failure in New Zealand. We were shooting a Mazda commercial where all these stickers fly, you know, through the air and land on this Mazda 6. We're not sure what it was that's done this, but we had 3 cameras on set because we had one in the air in a helicopter. We had another one on tracking vehicle in the Libra head and another one just sitting there as a backup. Thank goodness. And all of a sudden, our off and on switches, our GPO switches weren't working. But the R3D was perfect, but the quick times wouldn't play smoothly in our timeline and stuff like this. And we were sitting there thinking, hang on, what's going on here? But end of the day, the cameras still worked. They still shot pictures.
Yeah.
But their quick times, for some reason, that the proxies were no good, or off and on the cameras weren't working via the Preston and by this other little, you know, the view factor.
Yep.
Switches, they weren't working. Nothing was working. But the end of the day, was the red button at the back still worked and the camera still shot images and off we just kept moving on. You know, that was about it. That was about the only failure that we've had. And mind you, the cameras do copper hiding. We've had them hanging off arms, off cars, with the, you know, swinging in the breeze. They get rained on. They've been sitting out in the desert sun. They've been snowed on. They've copped a complete hiding, to be honest, and we're probably the hardest on cameras, to be honest, even though my camera assistant is fastidious with making sure these things are looked after. At the end of the day, you know, hanging a camera off of a car rig of some form is massive amounts of vibration that goes through those things.
Yeah.
And it's been handling it fine.
So for the rig stuff, you're shooting on card then, or are you still using drives?
We've been using the cards a lot lately. The drives, we've done homemade bungee things for them and doing everything we can, but I'm actually really finding the cards the way that we're going for two reasons. It's one is because they're so robust, you don't have any drop frames with them, or we haven't anyway. And a good thing about it is it makes us back up far, you know, often. So we've got a good system on set to where, you know, we've got multitude of cards. So every time we shoot one, it just goes into the hands of the data angler. They go back to the truck and just load her up. And because it's only 4 minutes of footage, they stick their heads out of the truck and just give me the thumbs up, meaning footage is good, and we just, you know, we're still moving. So
gate's clear.
But with the drives, you know, you tend to just keep shooting, and then you don't back up until lunchtime. And the thing is, you could wipe away your whole bloody morning shoot if you don't keep an eye on that stuff.
Are you shooting 16 gigs or the 8 gigs?
Oh, no, the 8s at the moment. Those 16 gig cards, even though I ring up Red and cry on the phone and carry on, That they're still not going to give me one earlier than I need them, but yes, it's look, I'll tell you what I'm really looking for is those 16 good cards. I really can't wait for those.
Yeah.
It's 8 minutes of footage. It's bulletproof. It's yes, we'll probably just use those only. We'll probably drop the drives off until solid state drives come out.
Yeah.
The drives we don't mind using, the spinning ones in studio situations, we find them very good.
There's something very filmy and very latent image about the cards. I think there's something very simple about them that it's there, you know it's there.
I'm with you. I'm not a big fan of drives.
Now, you also did a couple of other big around-the-world spots for Griffith Uni, again on the red with really small crew.
Yeah, that was great. That was a great ad to do. It was the client rang us up and they had X amount of dollars. I won't tell you how much. But we priced the ad up on film because they wanted film. To do it on film, we were going to be 12 days behind schedule for a completed commercial. Also, the cost of hiring your film cameras and everything in different countries and, you know, you're buying your stock and hanging around in each town, doing your one light grades, making sure that they're all done on time, getting your tape dubs and waiting in those countries for 2 days extra or another day, waiting to make sure everything's good before you fly away.
Yeah.
Added to so much time to the production. The cost of film, obviously, because we shot so much, we did 5 countries in 9 days, which you could barely do on film unless you flew off knowing that your film wasn't processed yet. And we dragged our cameras around with us in knapsacks, believe it or not. End of the day, you know, you still need your visas, you still need it. And you could do that guerrilla stuff and you could do it permitless and hope for the best, but a red camera is not small. A red camera still looks like a big camera. And it creates attention and a lot of attention. The stupid thing was everyone on the street in New York and in Barcelona they all knew what a red camera was for some reason. So as we're shooting, there's all these people just coming out going, is that the red camera? Is that the red camera? You're like, how do these people even know what this thing is, you know? But wherever we've been around the world, there's people coming and they're wanting to hold it, so we put it on their shoulders and people are taking photos of themselves holding it. It was ridiculous. So, you know, the red camera really stirred a lot of attention.
And obviously it worked. There was no real issues with gear and you got through.
Well, yeah, the only things I hate doing with world jobs is getting your international carnet set up before you left. And because your camera's only got 3 numbers on it, they think, is that the serial number? And you go, yes. and they all think it's worth a lot more than what it is because you write down $20,000 in your carnet and they all think it's 120 grand and they start questioning you on the price of it and all that sort of stuff. But irrespective of that, the shoot went great. And the way we did it, because of the budget, but the big look that I wanted for it, because originally the ad was only going to get shot in Brisbane, we were going to green screen all the backgrounds, and I thought, naff.
Yeah,
I've done it before. Yep. It's all good, but you've got no real control. You've just got a one angle bit of control, and you can't get that real freedom. And I thought, no, let's just do this one for real. We'll whiz around the world and knock all these shots off. So what we did, we just set up. We took 2 bodies with us. One as a backup, really. You know, at the end of the day, it's a computer. It's not a sewing machine like the old one, like 435 is. It's a computer and you've got to treat it like one. So we got these 2 knapsacks from Lowepro. We put the 2 red bodies in there. We put some super speeds in there and the 18 to 50 red zoom. Yeah, so we put all the lenses in there and matte boxes and batteries and so forth and threw it in our shoulders and off we went around the world. And there was 4 of us on the whole shoot. There was the client, the creative director, my camera assistant, which I always use, and myself.
Fantastic.
And off we went.
Sounds wonderful.
It was fabulous. And because I'm usually on shoots for 50, 60 people on it all the time, to have a 4-person crew was just great. I just loved it. It was like going back to, you know, back in my little days when I was a nobody.
Still shoot.
It was just fantastic. And we got the most amazing images, and it all went so well to plan, except, oh, actually, we've got one little thing I want to talk about. There's the reason why we do decent backups. I was in Greece. We're in the Greek islands, and my room got knocked off.
Ah.
And they stole the computer, the hard drives, everything just went. And, I ran around with my head, like a chook with my head cut off for about an hour or two, calmed down, realized that my camera assistant had he had another hard drive with all our backups. So we make sure that we've always got backups on drives all over the place. So great for us, we didn't lose 5 days of shooting around the world. We just lost nothing, or lost the laptop, and a drive.
Yeah, if it's not in two places, it's nowhere.
That's right. So it was the best thing we ever did, and away we went.
So you just went with a tripod and 18-50 and a couple of bodies?
Yeah, we took the 18-50. That was our prime lens for all the daylight stuff, and I took some super speeds with us as well, just to do some night stuff. And yeah, that was it. The 18-50 was—it's a far better lens than I ever dreamed of. For the money, we only bought that as a backup, just for a bit of fun. But it's been copping a hog, and it's—we've had it hanging off helicopters and cranes and everything. And
it's a great range.
Oh, it's just an incredible lens. We've got a 15-40 Optimo that we hire a lot, and to me, that's just a beautiful lens.
Yeah.
And. Contrast-wise, tonal and clarity, it's up there with it. One costs $6,000 and one costs $64,000 or whatever it is. But I'm not taking away from the Cook. I've got a lot of Cook lenses, and I'm a big fan of the Cook stuff, and even a bigger fan of the Ultra Primes and the Master Primes. But those red lenses definitely put a dent on a lot of jobs. They're fantastic.
Fantastic. Okay, the $64,000 question. Well, the $40,000 question, sticking with red ones, or are you going to bump them up to epics?
Yeah, we'll bump them all up to epics.
Yeah, I thought so.
And the stupid thing is I don't know why. I keep looking at the epics going, look, I'm in a 4K overkill already. I don't need what I'm shooting already. I'm downsizing 16 times to get to TV.
Speed for you. You want to do a lot of overcranking.
Yeah, well, that's what I'd love, a 4K image at 100 frames a second, 150, whatever they're going to get it to, and that's the only reason we're going to go to the epics.
Yeah.
So, other than that, the red ones are great. They're better than good. But our jobs are so big, and a lot of your listeners might think you lucky prick, but just every job we do technically pays off one camera.
Yeah.
So to us, the red camera is very disposable, and that's why we have backups, and that's why we've ordered so many of them. We've really upset the apple cart up here, because we've bought all of our own equipment. We've got all our own edit suites. We do everything now, and because of this huge economic downturn that we're in, budgets are shrinking wildly. I was getting a bit sick of money leaving Zoom. I wanted to keep it back in, so the only way to do it was to get all this gear, and the red has been a big asset.
Yeah, look, every time you hire a camera and you realise, geez, I could have bought a red with that.
Yeah, that's right. Films had its day. It's a great medium, and I still love the top end of film and the bright highlights. But
Build 16 is getting close, I reckon.
We really expose now to suit those highlights. So all we do is we see them burn out in the EVFs or the monitors. We just pull it back up half stop. It's fixed. Like we do not have problem with highlights, and we do car stuff. And when a silver car and bright sunlight's coming at you in the middle of the day, and you've got hot spots all over it, by the time it goes to air, you can't see them because we shot around it. I just love the control we have, and I love the grading ability we have, and I love the speed, and I love the whole bloody box and dice, to be honest.
Fantastic. Where can people find you?
www.zoomfilmtv.com.au.
If you go through to Mark's side of things, there's an online reel there, and all of the jobs we've been talking about, including some of the older Yamaha stuff, I think, Mark.
Too much. There's too much stuff up there. To put it all off, and clients go, where is it? So you put it back on again. So
exactly. If it's good, leave it in. Griffith University stuff is there, and the Yamaha stuff, and there's plenty of stuff. So
no, it's good. It's good to share some of this, because I'd like to see a lot of people starting to do it the easy way, not the hard way, and start getting the best out of red for a change. I don't want to get any more phone calls from DOPs whinging.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No worries, Chase. You have a great day, mate.
Cheers, mate. Thanks.
Okay, well, that was great. I really liked speaking to Mark at last. It was great to have a chat with him.
Such a nice guy.
Yeah. So he says he's still looking for... I mean, he's got all this gear in-house. He's looking for the in-house... I think the next piece in his puzzle, as he mentions in there, would be the in-house grading thing. So I think he... Obviously, at the moment, they're sort of going off and doing a lot of their grading with, you know, in Inferno or in your online suite. But I think he'd welcome having his own grading suite in there. I think he's quite happy sort of... That sort of Still's background, you know, it's happy doing a lot of it, owning it and keeping it in-house.
Now, Mark's done something for us, which we're going to put in the show notes, which is really kind of him. He's got his five steps to doing stuff using Red Alert. So to tweak something in Red Alert, to get it into Final Cut, to be able to avoid having to, you know, output everything as DPXs and stuff. And it's a simple five-step procedure. I've covered it in FX PhD before. It's kind of based on something that I started with him when I went up there as a way of working, and he's just taken it a bit further and loves it to death. So we'll publish it in the show notes. But basically, it's using Red Alert's ability to regenerate the QuickTimes that mean that you get stuff looking pretty good in Red Alert, regenerate the QuickTime proxies, which is instant, and then automatically load them, as it does, in Final Cut. And so if you've got a shot in Final Cut you want to tweak, you just tweak the original file in Red Alert.
Yeah, and there it is in Final Cut Pro Timeline.
So we'll put that in our show notes as well.
And then you export from Final Cut Pro, and I guess then that look follows through to... he talks about exporting... I think he talks about exporting...
He sorts QuickTimes out of Final Cut for uncompressed for Flame and stuff.
Yeah.
But just because it's a little easier to see rather than just describe, yep. I'll include that or other...
Again, this is another one to go and definitely go and download the show notes. There's lots of links to this gear and links to Mark's pages. Zoomfilmtv.com.
Yeah. Hey, so let's now discuss gear. And in the world of gear, we alluded to something last week that we didn't have time to cover. Not that this week's been particularly a brief ep, but anyway. A PL mount R8 lens.
Yeah, now I've seen this lens before as a stills. Thing. I've almost bought one for one of my cameras, but maybe he's not alone, but Long Valley Equipment make a PL mount version of this. It's basically, it's called a Peleng lens, P-E-L-E-N-G. It's made in Minsk, Belarus, and it's a very simple sort of Russian, fabulous sort of typical sort of Russian engineering, but it's a great 8mm lens. If you want a fantastic fisheye looking shot, it's fantastic. And the thing's, it's like $795. I reckon that's just, you know, that's a fantastic thing to chuck in the kit bag if you're setting up a shot and it's not quite working, this sort of shot, whack it in.
What's the field of view on that, and you know, how fisheye is it? Does it see like 120? Does
it
see
the full 180?
Wow.
And what it does is, with a lot of the fisheyes, and with some, if you put some of the Nikkors and stuff on, and even if you, the Panavision, some of the Panavision fisheyes, you will have to crop in or blow up later to get rid of vignetting on the corners. Theoretically, there's a diagram here showing that this is giving you full coverage of certainly the red frame, and theoretically meant to be on 35mm, Super 35 frame, you should get full coverage with no vignetting. And what would be interesting to see some proper shots of this thing, but I'd love to see it because I guess it's quite easy to take that lens distortion out in post. I'd love to see how wide a shot you get if you take away the fisheye effect,
the guys
or some of it.
At the factory in Minsk are listening. If you send me a lens, I will do testing with it and uncurvature, spin it out. And do all sorts of interesting HDR stuff and all sorts of marvellous things with it, and then tell you the answer to that.
Well, this is actually Long Valley Equipment who take this lens and then modify it. So,
oh, I see. I'm sorry.
Yep. So,
it's Long Valley that we need. So that's really important.
Exactly.
I thought this was the original
in New Jersey in the States.
Okay. So this they're sourcing the lens and then PL mounting it.
Exactly. The original lens, I think, might even be like a screw mount, or they make a Nikon mount. I've seen a few sort of versions of this, but this is the first one I've seen that actually has the Nikon mount sort of fitted to it.
You mean the PL mount?
PL mount fitted to it, sorry. So
we like Long Valley. They're nice people.
It's a lens that's it's designed for aerospace and topographic stuff and aerial mapping and things like that. And that's the company makes lenses like this. So it's not exactly a film lens, but hey, look, fisheye, cool.
Because this would go like on an Arri or anything with a PL mount, right?
Yeah, exactly. It gives you full coverage on any if you put it on a 4.35 or whatever. I think there's something funky with the filtering though. It comes with a few filters. You got them there, Mike.
Well, because you can't front filter.
You can't. Yeah, seriously, because it'll see anything you put in front of. If you put a big 6-inch, maybe a 6-inch, 6.6-inch piece of glass, you might. You won't get coverage.
180 degrees.
It'd have to be a curved filter.
Yeah.
So obviously the fix with these kinds of lenses is rear mount. So I think it comes with it's like
rear
an
mount
ND
filters.
And
yeah.
85s and NDs and possibly a rear polar that come with the kit. For $7.95, that's pretty good plus shipping. So again, we'll put what's the address for those guys? LongValleyEquipment.com. LongValleyEquip.com.
Yeah.
Long
it's actually, I have an 8mm or equivalent of an 8mm on my 35mm 5D, and I love it.
Yeah.
But I use it for SDR, HDR stuff, so.
Right. Would there be, I mean, it's kind of thing, it's a funky sort of one-off kind of lens, and it's a pretty good price for that kind of thing, the amount of use you'll sort of get on it.
Does it come with a warning to not shoot looking up at jumbos landing at airports?
The objects in the viewfinder may be closer than they seem.
Yeah, it's like a reminder of that. You know, at the beginning of Monty Python's original screening of, gosh, I'm going to say Life of Brian, where they had a travel log, but it was a fake travel log.
Right.
You know the days you used to have shorts before films? Yeah.
Was it about Norway or something?
No. It just looked like a travel log. It
right.
As boring as anything. And I was in a packed cinema. And you thought it was just a normal, and then you could go to Saint-Tropez.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
And then finally it goes, and then you could go to Sunny Isle. Fuck off. A bunch of boring press. Sorry. Anyway, in those travel logs, they used to always have that shot of the jumbo jet landing on a fisheye. Where it would sort of bend across.
It's the opening shot of Hawaii 50, isn't it?
There you go. I was thinking that it was Miami Vice, but
I think
that's flamingos. Okay, so what other equipment news do we have?
Okay, well, while I was there looking at this lens, I came across that 8mm because I went there originally to look at they also make a Nikon red mount. So this is a little bit different to some of the other ones, which it's sort of designed to, like I think the Berger mount has this sort of amazing sort of electronic controls for controlling the iris. This mount here is designed to work with G lenses and the DX lenses, lenses that essentially do not have a manual iris control. So essentially, obviously, when those are put on Nikon DX cameras, the iris is controlled electronically by the camera. So essentially, it's very simple. It has a little sort of essentially like a little thumb screw arrangement. You put your DX mount, DX lens, or your G lens on there, and you can essentially just open and close the iris manually with this little thumb screw. It's a workaround, but if you've got a lot of these lenses knocking around, it's great. I mean, it's not ideal if you want to do any iris pulls or anything. I don't think. I mean, there is, when you go to their website, there's an interesting video there about how to sort of calibrate your thumb screws on with sort of putting tape on the monitor and looking at waveforms, and so you can do a little sort of markings if you do want to do any sort of finite control. But I think for set and forget kind of irises, if you're out there doing sort of landscapes or stuff like that, then if you don't need to do precise and control of your iris by hand as you shoot, That's a good little thing. And the mount itself is $295. At the moment, they are shipping now. At the moment, they're only shipping to people that do have the current Nikon mount, just because the stock is limited. But, yeah, I thought that was pretty good. Nikon mount for $295.
Seems like a deal. And I have to replace my PL mount, so this doesn't sit on top of what... Does it violate my warranty, or does it sit on in...
Good question.
Because I think that's the thing, right? Like, I've had offers to... You want to test this, you know, Nikon mount I've had. All you have to do is screw your red camera apart. I think, I just want to do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think if Jim had wanted me to do that, he'd have had a button there for it.
Yeah, well, perhaps, it is a total... It's not a little tiny little add-on to the front of people who already have their Nikon mount. This is actually a totally replacement for the actual red Nikon mount. This is... So, yes, you're definitely going to have to possibly void your warranty. I don't know. If you go to the website there, there's some how-to videos about putting it on and adjusting it, so hopefully there'll be something in there if this looks like it's your bag. Sorry, that was the limit of my research, Mike.
That's right.
There's one other thing
that I wanted to flag as news. My more way of clarification than anything, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but the SDK, just like a final and closing note, the SDK we've been talking about that opens up Red to other users, I think I said, and I was right at the time, that the SDK was being implemented by people like Adobe and Autodesk and stuff. We've since learned that, in fact, Adobe has signed a deal with Assimilate, and I'm pretty sure I didn't mention this last week, and that means that the Adobe access will go beyond the SDK to full decode, dematrixing and stuff of the R3D files, and so that's pretty significant. There's more stuff coming from that alliance between Adobe and Assimilate, but we featured it in an episode of FX Guide TV, which you can see at fxguidetv.com. fxguide.com/TV. What am I saying? fxguidetv.com. You'd think I'd know my own website by now, right?
What is the link for your site?
Yes, then, yes. fxguide.com. And at the site, you'll see that there's a link, or you can just go to it directly. And it's...
If you do, it is...
fxguide.com/fxguidetv. And, so in that, we cover what's going on coming up with the...
What will that mean to us, though, Mike?
Actually, it means that there's more integration to Adobe than we previously thought. We had heard rumors that, well, not even rumors, Apple was saying that Color was going to open up to actually read the R3Ds and that Final Cut would open up to actually read the R3Ds. But I'm pretty sure I hadn't heard of any other company that was going in this far other than Assimilate that was already there. Most companies are just going through the R3Ds. So that's just a clarification, I guess.
Because obviously, in the last few days, CS4 has been released, so I'm wondering what if there's any
There is actually no official red thingy in CS4. It'll be a additional thing rather than being already built in. It's not like if you buy CS4, it's going to do 3Ds out of the box.
Right. Okay. Because
and I don't think that actually has been released. It's been announced. I don't think you can actually buy it yet because I'm on. I have a copy for press reasons. I do. I mean, it's a legal copy. It's not like an illegal, but it's not a... I think it's a beta copy. But anyway, it's. I'm pretty sure it's not an actual release yet. Okay. But we're going to be following closely what happens with the third parties like Adobe and their support of R3D files. Well, that's it for this week.
Okay.
You have been shooting during the week, right?
Yeah, I was shooting last week and just got a shoot confirmed for next week, which is, again, would be red. But again, I haven't really... driven that decision. I think producers and people all around me are starting to.
Why don't you rent my camera for a change?
Okay, I will.
We were using our camera yesterday. And we're shooting cloud tanks and water stuff. Anyway, so we're down at the beach, right? This is such a classic DOP thing. We're down at the beach, and I'm standing there beside our DOP, and we're shooting these waves crashing on the rocks because we wanted to shoot 120 frames of something, you know, really
right,
as you would. And so this wasn't being cut into a, an ad for male enhancing products or anything. But it was just, you know, what you do. And we're doing this for FX PhD for next term. Okay, so we're shooting it. And I'm like standing there for ages where we're shooting these, you know, waiting for the wave that will give exactly the right characteristics of smashing against these rocks. And I go, well, we should probably move on now because the water's been coming in since we've been standing here, right? And everyone's like, hmm? And I go, after a bit, and I'm like, And I'm thinking, well, you know, kind of, I'm a founder of this company. Somebody should be listening to me. Anyway, okay. So, okay, it's time to move on. Let's pack up. I think we've got the shot. And you know what happens when you've not got a pressing deadline? It's like DRPs just don't shot. They don't stop, right?
Oh, look, it's just getting better and better.
One more.
Better.
It's getting so much better. It's getting better because the friggin' tide's coming in. So then I point out, actually, our path back to shore has already diminished. We now have at least an inch of water to walk through, which is fine. I'm okay with that, to get back. But, you know, when we came, it was dry. Now it has risen, obviously.
Were you carried back?
Well, no, this is the thing, right? I'm standing there, and I just one more shot. Just, oh, wait, one more. And then the next thing we know, this mother of a wave hits. I leap down and grab our expensive gear and lift it up off the deck, and we get a wave that comes through about just under our knees. So the bottom of the tripod and all of us up to our knees are just standing in water. And I'm looking at the red camera thinking, if this tips over, I'm just filling out the insurance claim is going to be a nightmare. But as it happened, I don't think it got wet. And we went back to the crew vehicle and cleaned everything off. And I was like, right, so you're buying the fucking lattes.
Oh, you could just get an Epic. Oh, no, hang on. Anyway, scratch that.
Anyway, we...
Now, and you mentioned about shooting some cloud tank stuff.
I will talk more about that next week when we can talk about all the wonderful things happening
around
PhD. I love
cloud tanks.
Look, guys, thanks so much for hanging with us, and we really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm unfortunately going to be joined again by... No, I'm just joking. It's been great. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, thanks.
Until next time, guys. See ya. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.